Many experts believe we could be at a turning point for abortion rights in the United States. The Supreme Court is considering a big abortion case this term, and Texas just enacted a ban on nearly all abortions after about 6 weeks in pregnancy. At a hearing on reproductive rights last week, Congresswoman Cori Bush made her case for strengthening abortion rights before a House committee. She shared her own experience of how she became pregnant as a teenager and chose to get an abortion.
My abortion happened on a Saturday. I felt alone, but I also felt so resolved in my decision. Choosing to have an abortion was the hardest decision I had ever made. But at 18 years old, I knew it was the right decision for me.
At that same hearing, Congresswoman Barbara Lee said she received a so-called back-alley abortion in Mexico. In fact, before the Supreme Court's 1973 decision in Roe v. Wade affirmed a constitutional right to an abortion, women took many measures to terminate their pregnancy, including crossing into Mexico. And now many abortion rights advocates fear we may see more of that. Lena Maria Murillo is an assistant professor of gender, women's sexuality studies, and history at the University of Iowa. She's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Fighting for Control, which documents the history of reproductive care and activism in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Professor, welcome.
Hi, thank you very much for having me, Jane.
Professor, you just wrote a piece in the Washington Post. It's called Before Roe v. Wade, U.S. Residents Sought Abortions in Mexico. And you trace the abortion access for women in the United States and Mexico as far back as the 1860s. Women have been crossing the border into Mexico for generations to end their pregnancies. Tell us how common it has been.
So I started in the 1860s because that's when we start to see in the United States laws that begin to want to curtail women's own ability to control their reproduction. Now, in the 19th century, abortion was considered still a realm that was dominated by women, midwives. And so in the 1860s, we see a change, and that is that physicians began to suggest, as they began to professionalize, that they were actually better equipped to sort of handle issues of reproductive care. By the end of the 19th century, we see that almost every state in the United States has laws banning abortion. Under certain cases, people could get abortions, but only with a physician. And so in that period, abortion went underground, even in the United States. So you have abortion providers providing abortion into the 20th century. So in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s. What happens in the 1940s is that this is right after World War II. You had women who had gone out to work in industry, right, to take up the work that GIs had left behind in order to go fight. And when these men return, right, there's this sort of moral panic about where women's place should be. And one of the places that sort of gets attacked are these underground abortion providers. And so in that period of the 1940s, you see people start to go to Mexico for abortion care.
And at that point, abortion was not only illegal in Mexico, but there were also attacks against providers. So how did abortion providers continue to practice in Mexico, and how did the government allow it?
Mafia-type organizations formed around some of these providers to offer them protection from law enforcement. By the time of the late 1960s, Mexico, places like Ciudad Juarez, right across the border from El Paso, were awash in people seeking abortion care.
So let me back up a little bit, back to the last question about how these procedures were allowed by the government. Police, attorneys, judges, they turned a blind eye to this emerging business along the U.S.-Mexico border.
They absolutely did. And again, what I want to sort of put forth in my work is that this was also happening in the years before 1940 in the United States. Judges, other physicians, the police turned a blind eye in the U.S. Because fundamentally, they understood that it was a service that people were going to seek out regardless of the laws.
And during this time, women were exposed to horrific and sometimes deadly procedures, and there were deaths from complications. Explain the vetting process for providers.
So in Juarez specifically, which is one of the places I look at, what the Society for Humane Abortion would ask patients to do would be to go get the procedure done and then write a survey and explain how they had been treated, what drugs had been used. Many of these people were physicians, so they would ask these physicians for their credentials, right? Where did you go to college? Can we see your medical license? And many times providers would provide this information.
But there were plenty of stories from doctors in El Paso of women crossing back over the border to get treatment after bungled procedures in Mexico.
Absolutely. And that was likely because they did not go to these vetted physicians or vetted providers. One of the horrific case out of Nogales, this was, you know, sister city to Nogales, Arizona, where a young woman by the age of 18, you know, died of a botched abortion. She was from California. And in fact, after that case, when they raided the clinic, Mexican law enforcement said it was one of the most beautiful, pristine clinics they'd ever seen. One of the most luxurious was actually the word they use, clinics they had ever seen. So the notion of the sort of dirty, dingy, back alley abortion doesn't necessarily mean that you were going to get, you know, even having the most luxurious places to say, didn't mean that you were going to have a good abortion experience, right? People invested lots of money into this business because it was so profitable at the time.
And it wasn't just Mexico. You also found that women were traveling from the U.S. to countries like Japan, where abortion became legal in 1948. You found bank statements and transactions of women who'd gone to Japan. Tell us about that.
The healthcare experience of women who traveled to Tokyo was incredible. And some of the most detailed reports that we see are from women going to Japan. And in fact, one of the saddest reports I read was of a woman talking to a doctor. He sort of came to her and said that he was having this moral crisis about providing abortion care to American women. And he said, you know, women should not have to travel all the way to Japan for what should be basic health care. And I feel that this is something that you need to take care of in your country. And for that reason, he decided no longer to provide abortion care to American women after this one patient he had.
Roe v. Wade is 48 years old now, but the battle for abortion rights certainly is not over. What should states be considering now when it comes to women's reproductive rights? And what should women be considering in this moment?
I think what states need to consider, those who that are concerned and care for bodily autonomy. I mean, this is fundamentally what this is about. It's about having control over your own body. Those states that care about those things need to sort of prepare for the end of Roe, because that is on the horizon. The Supreme Court is about to take on a case out of Mississippi that will effectively, you know, take down the last few legs that Roe is standing on at this moment. Now, what do women and pregnant people need to do? We have always found ways to fight cruelty when it comes to denying us our rights. There are incredible activists on the ground now working in conjunction with people in other countries, right? So you see in the border region activists reaching across the national boundary. So we're going to see new networks created to help people and support people on their journey for reproductive care.
That's Lena Maria Murillo. She's an assistant professor of gender, women's sexuality studies and history at the University of Iowa. She's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Fighting for Control, which documents the history of reproductive care and activism in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane.